believe unity is more possible than ever before in this race. We need to unite behind Ted Cruz.
Every person here today is enormously powerful if you choose to use your power.
We're all in this together.
The 45% tax is a threat.
It's not a tax, it was a threat.
It's not China that pays the tax. It's you, the working men and women. So ask yourself at home, how is this helping you?
And so far, I cannot believe how civil it's been up here.
I was with Dr. Ben Carson today, who's endorsing me, by the way, tomorrow morning.
If we nominate Donald Trump, Hillary wins.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It is Friday. Good morning, everyone. It is March 11th, 2016. Welcome to it. Thanks for joining us on The Opening Bell today. We have a lot to talk about. Big show for you today. Later in the program, on this fifth anniversary of the Japanese earthquake and tsunami, we talked to one of the world's experts on disasters about preparation, also the follow-up to that disaster, and what you could do to prepare, also the economic toll that a similar disaster like this might have on the U.S. That's coming up later in the broadcast. But first, your global intel. Asian stock markets mostly higher today, despite the bout of turbulence overnight brought on by the European Central Bank's announcement of additional stimulus measures. Investor cheer over the ECB's announcement of interest rate cuts was short-lived, as comments by Bank Chief Mario Draghi underscored the weakness of the 19-country eurozone and the desperation by monetary authorities to act. But after initially hearing heading southward, those Asian markets mostly bounced back. U.S. stocks swung between gains and losses yesterday, then ended right back where they started. Standard & Poor's got a gain just about a 0.02% higher. 1989 was the close. The Dow finished the day at 16,995. The Nasdaq finished the day at 46,62. Benchmark U.S. crude oil rose nearly a dollar to climb above 38.50 per barrel. The dollar weakened against the yen and gained against the euro. This morning on trading, Dow futures again are showing they are higher. They have been higher this morning. The Dow futures, let's refresh the screen here so we give the very latest, up 161 points now. S&P futures up 21. The Nasdaq futures are up 54. Oil trading 38.79 a barrel. There is a development this morning in the case of Apple versus the FBI, or FBI versus Apple, however you want to read it. The Justice Department says there's probable cause that a locked iPhone used by one of the San Bernardino killers contains evidence of the eventual attack. Federal prosecutors have filed new court papers that the government and the community need access to the phone. They say Apple must comply with a court order to make that device available. The response from the government sets a stage for a March 22nd hearing at which lawyers for Apple and the Justice Department will argue their case before a federal magistrate. The ECB, the European Central Bank's decision yesterday caused a lot of ups and downs on the markets. Joining us this morning, as he does regularly now on The Opening Bell, is Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago, a portfolio manager there. Paul, I know you were a little nervous yesterday watching all of that action, and the markets reacted kind of weirdly. Have things settled down this morning?
As is normal, after the central banks around the world make their pronouncements, we get a knee-jerk reaction, and the markets will tend to reverse that the following day. So even when the Fed meets, we get a knee-jerk reaction usually on that Thursday, and then Friday we get an opposite reaction when everybody gets a chance to sleep on it, and I think that's what's happened here.
It was a little surprising because it seemed like good news, and the markets started reacting pretty nicely. What was it that was the concerning point of it?
It was one sentence by Mario Draghi when he indicated in the press conference following that we're pretty well done. This is as much as we're going to be able to do. So the possibility of additional QE is off the board, and that was not received very well by the markets.
I know I mentioned as we were getting ready for the show today to you about this Brexit stuff, the European Union, Britain wanting to exit the European Union, perhaps. But the British Prime Minister seems to be throwing water on that take. Do we even need to worry about this here in the United States?
I really don't think so. I think the European Union, I think, is going to stay together. I mean, there were, the best opportunity, if you will, for that to break apart was Greece 2 years ago. So I really don't think that that's going to be an issue at this point for us.
Speaking of Greece, did you see yesterday they may ask for another bailout?
Not a big surprise. Again, they're struggling. They continue to struggle. That was not a surprise from the perspective that when the deal was done a couple years ago, it was meant only to kick the can down the road. And we're now down the road a couple years and we're back in the soup.
Do you think they're ever going to be able to pay that money back, or is it are they a failing state?
Greece has historically gone bankrupt. They have gone bankrupt 3-4 times over the last 80 years. So this is not necessarily a surprise.
We're talking with Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago. We'll get some more of his insights coming up and maybe some portfolio advice for you as you head into the weekend. Right now, though, let's check traffic. And good morning, Mary Vandeville.
ABC News, Wall Street Now. Asian stock markets were mostly higher overnight despite turbulence brought on by the European Central Bank's announcement of additional stimulus measures. Comments by the head of the ECB underscored the weakness in the 19-country eurozone. In this country, stocks swung wildly on Thursday and then ended right back where they started. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ saw only fractional changes by the close of trade. Volkswagen's top U.S. executive Michael Horn has been fired, apparently over his plan to give VW diesel owners gift cards and vouchers as a sign of goodwill. The company has admitted to installing software on VW diesel cars that cheats on government emissions tests. Over at Ford, meanwhile, the next generation of police cars will feature doors that protect officers from armor-piercing bullets. The doors on previous models of the Ford Interceptor would only stop handgun fire. Ford says police departments made frequent requests to upgrade the doors, especially in Middle Eastern and Eastern European countries. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
We're back on The Opening Bell. It's 520, and it's Friday morning. Thankfully, the end of the work week, end of the business week. Paul Nolte with us. Paul, let's talk about mortgage rates, interest rates, if we could. You were just telling me in the break that... You think we're sort of a banana republic, as it were. It's kind of crazy, isn't it?
If people were to talk 10 years ago about where rates could be in the future, something with a minus sign in front of it would have been incredibly unusual to be thinking about. But we see it around the world right now. 10-year rates in Japan are negative. Germany is very, very low. We're at 2%, which when you look at the global rates – is fairly high. Mexico, Brazil are certainly higher, but a lot of the developed countries are lower than we are, and we're still talking about raising our rates.
And just so that to remind people who may not be the business pros, the minus sign means what again?
We're below zero, so that it costs you money to put your money at a bank. Now, the practicality of that is different, so the depositor isn't necessarily losing money yet. But it's really more their government bonds are being loaned out at a negative rate. So it's actually costing you to buy those bonds.
It seems like every time we chat, I ask you if you've watched the Republican debate the night before, because there seems to be so many of them. But last night I was concerned a little bit about the discussion of taxes. And it was something that Donald Trump brought up about China, this 45% tariff. Is he pushing the envelope here? Will this create a trade war? And is this something that you're nervous about as a portfolio manager?
To be honest with you, like I said, there's a lot of talking points when we start talking about the debates. There's a lot of stuff that gets thrown out, and certainly Donald Trump is very good at throwing a lot of dust up in the air. So it's very. I'm still trying to figure out where he stands on almost anything. So. When we get closer to the general election in November, I think we'll have a better idea of true policies, we hope.
Gas prices are ticking up in the Chicago area. That's probably because of the reformulated gas, but oil prices seem to be going upwards as well. Is that an area that you're directing people?
Not yet. I mean, to be honest, we're in a new bull market. So if you define a bull market as a 20% gain, we're up over 20% from the bottom now in energy prices. But it's along the lines of a bounce that we've seen historically. We saw a bounce early part of last year in energy prices, only to see them roll down. Inventory levels are still extraordinarily high, so we still have an awful lot of energy inventory around. So we can see energy prices hang around this area for probably the remainder part of the year. But as far as new investments, not necessarily real aggressive on the energy side.
Are you monitoring the local action with United Airlines and their fight over control of that? I don't know if you have people, some of your clients holding United stock. Is that a concern?
No, actually, airlines historically have been, it has changed. Their business model has changed. But historically, airlines have been an area that we've really never invested in. And part of the reason for it was, you know, the model used to be, you know, we lose money on every seat, but we make it up in volume. They've changed that around now. It's a much more closer to a regular business model where they are actually looking at a surprise like banks. They make most of their money now in fees as opposed to on their ticket charge.
So as we head into the weekend, where are some good areas to put our money?
Well, really, when we're taking a look at the markets, we're still very much focused on the S&P 500, so large U.S. International is looking interesting, even with the Mario Draghi bazooka, if you will, for what they were doing with their monetary policy. Those markets are cheap, but we still think there's going to be a fair amount of volatility in the U.S. We've seen it this year. We saw it again last year. So safer places are going to be in the large U.S. We still do like bonds. I mean, even at current low interest rates, it's a nice offset to the stock market. So when we saw the sell-off a couple months ago, bonds held up well, and it's a nice offset to the stocks that you might own.
Your weekly commentary that I love reading, you say you're still waiting to see the evidence of the actual bottom, though, in the markets. Still feel that way today?
We do. You know, certainly we're much better than we were earlier a couple weeks ago. There's a lot more stocks that are trading above their short-term moving averages, and we're seeing a little bit more buying coming into the marketplace. So we may have put in at least a short-term bottom with the February low. But again, I think we're going to be capped on the top side because if the markets look halfway decent, it might embolden the Fed to raise rates. And we saw what happened when they raised rates in December. The market sold off. So we're kind of in that catch-22 when we talk about the markets going forward.
And it's interesting you mentioned the Fed again because they seem to be this week indicating that they're going to move forward at least one more time.
At least one more. It may not be at this meeting, but yes. And again, as I said, with the markets acting better, that gives the Fed more reason to say, yes, we can go ahead and raise rates.
Paul, good of you to be with us this morning. Glad you're with us every Friday on the opening bell. You kind of calm us a little. And when you smile, I love it when you smile because that means our money's doing decent.
Doing well. Paul, thank you.
Paul Nolte, Kingsview Asset Management Portfolio Manager. You can find Kingsview online at kingsview.com. Paul, have a great day. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
It's 5:27. This is the opening bell on WGN. Over to the newsroom. Vic Vaughn is standing by. Vic?
Well, it's all about politics today, Steve. We have a very different GOP debate last night to sift through today. Also, several presidential campaigns in the Chicago area ahead of Tuesday's Illinois primary to go over. Hillary Clinton here last night, Bernie Sanders, Cruz here today, and of course, Trump speaking tonight. So lots to cover coming up.
It's 5:27.
From ABC News, Tech Trends. It's like Uber for tow trucks. When you find yourself with a dead battery, a flat tire, or anything else requiring roadside assistance, a new app called Honk could save the day. Founder and CEO, Corey Brundage.
You can download our app, whether it's iPhone or Android, and anytime you need assistance on the side of the road, it's just a tap away.
Honk figures out where you are and how close a tow truck is. You're immediately given a price estimate plus any mileage charges if an actual tow is involved. There are no monthly or annual fees. And that aspect appeals to many.
You get to see the price before you order, so you know exactly what you're in for. And, you know, prices start at about $49 nationwide.
And just like Uber drivers, the tow truck drivers, like Eric Haber, can respond via the app as well.
A call comes in, you're alerted through a Honk, and you can immediately push the button to accept the call.
a no-strings-attached, pay-as-you-use-it service, where and when you need it. With Tech Trends, I'm Karen Chase, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
It's 5:37. Welcome back to the program. Japan is marking 5 years since a powerful earthquake triggered a tsunami that killed more than 18,000 people. At a gathering in Tokyo today, observed a moment of silence at the time the quake struck offshore, that beeping counting down to the exact moment. Some teared as they held hands or bowed their heads in prayer, and sirens sounded across the country. 180,000 people are still displaced because of the disaster, and almost 3,000 people are still missing. It was 2011. This is what it sounded like when that tsunami came in. The disaster is one that is on the minds of many people today, especially experts across this country. One of them, Chris Goldfinger, a paleoseismologist at Oregon State University, says the Pacific Northwest is overdue for a big earthquake and tsunami, and it could be devastating, he tells CBS News.
This would be like 5 or 6 Katrinas all at once, up and down from California to Canada. If it happens anytime soon, it would just devastate the area.
Daniel Aldrich is a professor of political science and co-director of the Security and Resilient Studies Program at Northeastern University. He researches post-disaster recovery. He's written quite extensively about Japan, and there's something called resilience and social structures that are being pushed as a new disaster preparedness. And Professor Aldrich joins us this morning from California, where he was giving a speech there. Professor, have we learned any lessons from the hurricane or the earthquake and also the tsunami?
So I think we have learned some lessons in the field of disaster management, but unfortunately, some of the most important lessons have been lost, not only on the American government, I think, but also on the Japanese government. You know, in the field of disaster management, I think we have learned the need to really take seriously the possibility of a worst-case scenario with a variety of ripple effects. You know, it's funny, you know, most of us envision disasters one at a time, an earthquake, a tornado, a storm. We don't really think through what would happen, for example, if a nuclear power plant loses power and then is flooded so that the backup systems won't work either. You know, that kind of what we call ripple effect or compounded disaster is perhaps going to become more common in the future as we have more systems that are connected, whether it's the internet, for example. You can imagine if a city lost Wi-Fi or cell phone signals for a few days, it'd be really hard to get stuff done. But if we had no internet access, we couldn't pay our bills. You know, a lot of us use Nest. You know, a lot of the things that we do nowadays come from expectations, assumptions about the continuity of the internet. Certainly in nuclear power plants, I think we assumed for a long time that a station blackout, where you completely lost all power and all backup systems, would be very unlikely. That myth has been put to rest. That's one lesson I think we have learned to some degree. I think, unfortunately, there are a number of lessons we haven't learned. One of the bigger ones that we've been focusing on in our research has been on not relying only on physical infrastructure. And a lot of the systems in place in Japan along the coast focused on things like seawalls. You know, the Japanese government envisioned that by building over 300 kilometers of seawalls in areas like Tohoku, it would keep them safe from a major tsunami like the one we saw. Well, several things were wrong about that. First of all, a number of the tsunami walls, even 30-foot walls, simply collapsed under the pressure of the tsunami. So in that sense, even the best engineering wasn't enough. But even beyond that, a number of people who didn't evacuate because they envisioned the wall as the only line of defense they needed to have. So why would I evacuate if I have a seawall? I'll stay there. And they lost their lives as a result of that. So I think in that sense, we've learned if you have seawalls in place, you must have other infrastructure as well. Evacuation, training, social infrastructure, neighbors helping neighbors get free. You need to have other systems in place beyond simply some kind of seawall there or whatever physical infrastructure will be. I think another broad lesson that we've seen here are the challenges, especially in rural areas. of recreating and reconstructing industries that were massively affected by a disaster. The fishing and farming industries in Tohoku in some areas are pretty much out of commission, maybe indefinitely. I think this lesson is a much more challenging one to implement. How do you ensure diversity in livelihoods? How do you make sure communities don't rely only on one main source of income, because that makes it much more vulnerable then to any kind of shock?
Is it surprising to you that 5 years later, there are still so many people that are displaced and so many people that are missing? 59,000 are still living in temporary homes, and then 174,000 still are displaced, and then about 3,000 people are still missing.
Yeah, so those are great questions. So first of all, let's start with the missing question. The Japanese government does distinguish between missing and dead. So if you actually add them together, we have over 18,500 casualties. But a number of families have yet to declare their missing loved ones as being dead, and the government will not push them to do so. We do have thousands, you know, probably tens of thousands of people who are in quote, what are called temporary shelters still. These are very flimsy, prefabricated boxes, and people are still in them 5 years later, probably tens of thousands of them. And we certainly have individuals who in areas like Fukushima are still not allowed to come back. There are areas in Japan that are still considered too hot, radioactively hot to come back into. So I think this is an unfortunate reality when you have a compounded disaster, and it's very challenging for the government to provide realistic and accurate information on what to do. You know, after Chernobyl, the government of Russia did not try to go through and make Chernobyl livable again. It declared it an off-limits zone. The Japanese government has been trying through a number of different methods to make Fukushima livable again.
The anniversary of the Japanese disaster has caused many to look at the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest. One paleo seismologist says that it's overdue for a big earthquake and possibly a tsunami. What is the impact not only on human life from something like that, but how would that impact the U.S. economy and the global economy?
I mean, certainly you can envision that if California, you know, whether it's Northern California, San Francisco and the Silicon Valley, or Southern California, Hollywood and Los Angeles, or certainly Seattle and Portland, you know, those are major economic areas. So I think most North Americans, including those who currently are vulnerable to tsunami, have not thought through the realities of living in what is certainly an area that is vulnerable to a future tsunami. And as you mentioned already, we have evidence from the past that these areas have been hit by tsunami. So, you know, Japan used the infrastructure approach, you know, building seawalls. That's a very expensive and inefficient way to protect communities. You know, the place to start for this, of course, is to move industries inland, to think through using natural things like roads as a berm, as a natural defense against a tsunami. Certainly, Wellington also in New Zealand is vulnerable to tsunami. They've tried to recreate the city and rebuild the city in ways that make its population safer, moving people away into the inland areas, into the upper areas and hills and mountains. You know, if we took it really seriously, that's what we'd start doing. I think the reality is, one of my colleagues told me, you know, if there were an offshore event, a seismic event off Oregon's coast, much of Portland, much of Seattle would be incredibly vulnerable. The combination of the depth of the ocean outside and the shape of the coast make those areas really at risk. So I think the reality is, you know, we don't think about this. Most North Americans, even those living in floodplains, whether it's in the Gulf Coast or elsewhere, don't think about these kind of things till afterwards. And it's really too late at that point.
FEMA has said that the best case scenario is 10,000 people dead, tens of thousands injured. Is this something that we're prepared for? Obviously, it's happened to other countries, but is it something that America is prepared for?
No, I do not think that we are. We're a nation that is not prepared for large-scale disasters. I know we have gotten better. FEMA has gotten better since Hurricane Katrina. Their response in Sandy was good. But the reality is FEMA does not make the recovery, right? FEMA literally only helps to cut checks for rebuilding processes. They cannot convince people to come back. They can't restore lives that are lost. They can't restore businesses that were lost, right? All they can do is cut checks, right? They're not some miracle agency. So even if they're better at their job, which they are, I believe, in 2016 versus 2005, we, the people living in vulnerable areas, it's up to us to make changes to the things that we do, where we build our homes, the kind of houses that we build, the kind of networks that we have, how we think through what's going to happen in disaster, you know, data backup. There are all kinds of things that we can do that are relatively low cost right now that will save us literally billions of dollars. You know, the cost to Japan of this accident has been $250 billion. And the reality is Tohoku is nowhere nearly as productive as California or Oregon. Certainly Oregon, Seattle, the Bay Area, those are areas where we have a lot of knowledge industries. We have Silicon Valley. We have Hollywood. A lot of industries that depend on infrastructure. They expect to keep going. They expect continuity to happen. So, you know, I can only imagine how high the cost would be if we were hit on the West Coast, for example, from a tsunami like it hit Japan.
And that brings us to one of the things that you're active in, and that is this idea of resilience and having social connections and being ready to take care of ourselves if something like this happens.
During a disaster, most of us think about our survival in terms of food and water, which are really important elements. But the reality is that more important than just having food and water is having a strong social network. This means not having Facebook or LinkedIn or virtual networks, but having face-to-face friends, friends who are neighbors, friends who live nearby, kin, family, colleagues that you know, the people who do the worst during disasters are individuals with the fewest connections, whether they're young or old, rich or poor. What really helps us out is having a network that's broad and diverse. So the process of resilience doesn't just come from making sure that we have food and water. It comes from making sure that we have strong connections, face-to-face, real-world connections to people around us who have resources, information that we don't. And that makes us stronger, right? I can borrow a tool from them to knock out the rotting drywall. My house is damaged. I need someone to keep looters out. Those are all procedures that don't have government equivalents. The government cannot watch your house all the time. Cops can't be there, but your neighbors can. You need to have face-to-face connections, people that can knock on their door and ask for help. I know their last name, their first name. I've been there before. I've invited them over for coffee. We've met at the park with our kids. We've gone on a walk together, picked up trash. The more activities that we can do before disaster strikes together, that makes us more likely to work together when the disaster comes. So the more activities we have in common, whether it's volunteering together or taking a walk together, saying hello every day, getting your neighbor's mail, shoveling their driveway when the snow comes, any activities that we can do to strengthen those bonds, that makes us more resilient to disaster.
There has been a lot of attention paid to an early warning system for earthquakes and new technology. Is that something that we should rightly be focused on, or is it more these social connections that you're pushing?
You know, if we could get technologies like that, an early warning system, that'd be fantastic. It's not there yet. Rather than waiting for a few elite scientists to develop some kind of early warning system, it's much more effective for a million new Americans to go to a 4-H club, to a Kiwanis club, to an opera club, to go outside and pick up trash in the park, to say hi to their neighbors, to do an act of kindness for them, to bring flowers to people, to bring food to shut-ins. Those are the kind of activities that all of us can easily do. It won't require any new money. It won't require any new government initiatives or spending and research and design. So the things that we can do right now to build up our social capital, to build up these connections, I think it's a much better use of our time, for example, and our money than waiting for some kind of technology to come down the pipeline.
Professor Daniel Aldrich, you can find him on Twitter at Daniel P. Aldrich of Northeastern University, an expert in this field. He, by the way, is the author of a book called Building Resilience, How to Survive Disaster with Social Connections. Again, on Skype with us this morning from California. We're a little late this morning for traffic, but standing by is Mary Vandeville.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program. Dow futures are mostly higher this morning, as well as the NASDAQ and S&P futures. Let's get the latest on commodities now. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Steve, good morning. It continues to be an interesting week in the commodity trade. At the Chicago Board of Trade, for example, for the seventh straight day, wheat ended the day higher. And that's the longest streak we've seen in the wheat market in nearly 2 years, thanks to a weaker dollar and ongoing concerns about some not-so-kind crop weather. Soybeans also up for a seventh day yesterday. Corn moved higher for the sixth day in seven sessions, getting some support from stronger-than-expected export sales in that weekly Department of Agriculture report. And it was just a week ago the Commodity Futures Trading Commission data showed non-commercial traders holding their largest net short positions on record in corn, soybean, and wheat markets. So an interesting higher market again in the grain market with March wheat. Well, it went up 6.5 yesterday. March corn 3.5 higher, and March soybeans up 2 cents. And the live cattle trade at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange continues to move higher. As a matter of fact, sharply higher yesterday, short covering and wholesale beef prices moving higher as The retailers are looking beyond Easter and beginning to order beef for the summer grilling season and pork for the outdoor grilling season as well. And so yesterday, the April cattle contract up $1.52, and choice beef prices climbed $1.36 a hundredweight in yesterday's trade there. Fund rolling limited lean hog gains at the Mercantile Exchange, but some of the deferred months hit fresh contract highs yesterday. Farmers a little concerned about the presidential campaign and the lack of talk about agriculture, but the talk by several candidates of canceling trade agreements that have been in effect for a long time. That's worrying farmers and ranchers in this country. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You too. And that's the opening bell for this Friday. Have a wonderful weekend. The show's producer is Mary Sandberg. Production help from Ross Cochran. Our engineer today is Bob Ferguson. We'll be back bright and early on Monday morning at 5 o'clock for another edition of the opening bell. The Steve Cochran Show is next. Have a great day. It's 5:56.